Take RFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This programme was first broadcast on RFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
This year, University of Otago celebrates its 150th anniversary, bringing together students, staff, alumni and the wider Dunedin community for a busy programme of events. On Daring to be Wise, we talk with people from all corners of the university community. Inspirational stories from educators, administrators and those whose time at Otago made a lasting impression. Welcome to Daring to be Wise.
Well, 6 years ago, historian Dr. Ali Clark was assigned the task of writing a book about the history of the University of Otago over its 150 years. Published at the end of last year, the book was no doubt a huge undertaking. Let's find out more from Ali Clark. Ali, thanks for joining us. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Ali, tell us, how did this task come about your way?
Well, I'm not exactly sure about that. You'd have to ask the people who employed me, but they asked me if I was interested, and at first I was a bit overwhelmed. It seemed such a huge responsibility, but it was a very exciting project, and I decided that it would be a lot of fun to work on.
You would have been aware that there were previous histories, the 100th, for example?
Yes, there are two previous official histories of the university, one that came out for the Jubilee in 1919, and one that came out for the centenary in 1969. And there are quite a few other books too of individual parts of the university, and also a fantastic history of students at the university written by Sam Alworthy, and I think it came out in 1990, so that was celebrating the OUSA centenary.
So you had those existing resources. What then was your approach to how you would take on this task?
Well, one of the things I wanted to do was tell the history of the whole university over its 150 years. So it wasn't just of the time since the centenary. So I was looking back at that first 100 years and partly looking at the things that had been left out of the earlier histories. So they were very much stories of professors and because almost all the professors were men, they were very much stories of men. So I was conscious of that when I went in, that women and students even had been a bit left out of the previous history. So I went in looking at it through their eyes as well as through the administration of the university.
Where was your starting point? Day one of the job, what were you doing?
Well, the first thing I did actually was do some oral histories, which was absolutely fantastic. So I reported to a committee that was chaired by Barbara Brooks, Professor of History, and there was a group of people that were interested in the university history, and they had lots of ideas of great people for me to talk to. So I tried to talk to a range of people from different parts of the university, and that was just a great privilege, meeting some really interesting people. So that was one of the first things I did.
And was that so that you could sort of gain an overview of where the shape of this thing might go, or was it you got straight into gathering material that would be content for the book?
It was both in a way. So the people I spoke to, the great thing about speaking to people rather than reading reports or reading minutes or reading, I don't know, old reminiscences or something, is you can ask them specific questions. So there were things I was curious about that I had in mind to include in the book. I could actually ask people their experiences. And the fantastic thing was the oldest person I interviewed was actually 106 years old and had started working at the university in 1922 as a boy, as a technician.
So rich in memories and stories. Mm,
yes, that's right. And some of the people I spoke to were current staff. So people, for example, a good example would be people from the Gender Studies program, which was relatively recently established. So it was good to talk to them about how it came to be and how it's evolved and so on.
So you have that existing kind of human resource, those people who were literally still either working within the university or had been working within the university or had affiliations and associations with the university. What other resources were available to you on taking on this task?
Well, I delved into the university's archives, which are large and diverse, mostly held at the Hocken Collections, and I looked at a wide range of things in those. One of the great sources actually was the university newsletters, which had been written for staff and since the 1970s. So I read right through those and picked up lots of ideas from those and stories. I looked at what had already been published. I looked at reviews of university departments that are held periodically by the university. I looked at everything that had already been published. So, for example, there are quite a few histories of the medical school, and various departments have published histories as well. So I looked at a lot of material like that.
I imagine it would have become apparent to you that some areas of the university's history were covered very well. You had plenty to go on, as it were, and there would have been others where there were some notable gaps. Tell us about the areas that posed the greatest challenge for you here.
Well, one of the interesting things was some of the residential colleges that no longer exist. So there are a couple of, or there are three of those, I think, or maybe more. But one interesting one was Helensburgh House, which was set up, I think it was in the 80s, I can't remember quite off the top of my head. Yes, it must have been the 80s, when the university was in a panic because there'd been a sudden surge in enrolments as a larger proportion of school leavers were starting to attend university, and their population projections hadn't really prepared them for that, so they were short of accommodation. So at very short notice, the university arranged with the hospital board, as it was then, to lease the former nurse's home at Wakari Hospital and turned it into a university hall of residence. And it survived for quite a few years. In fact, the only reason it closed was because the hospital board needed the facility back because they were returning more patients to Wakari Hospital. So at that point, the university took on more of the old nurse's home at Dunedin and the former Queen Mary. So this Helensburgh House existed for maybe getting up towards 10 years, I think. And because it had always been seen as a bit temporary and so on, there wasn't much knowledge about it. And one of the things I did was I wrote while I was working on this project, I ran a blog about the university history. And I posted a piece about Helensburgh House, and lots of people responded with their memories of it. And the former warden got in touch with me, so then I interviewed her. So that was quite an interesting story.
Why the blog? Why did you run a blog through this process?
Well, when I started out on the project, there was a website going for a group called the History of the University Unit, which had been set up to support people around the university who were researching histories of particular parts of the university. And the original idea was that people could send in their reminiscences and information to that, but it hadn't really been kept going, so I thought it would be good to start something else that would allow people to interact with the project. And it was an opportunity for me to put things out there and encourage people to get in touch, and like people help me identify photos or remembered particular things about something I was trying to find more about. And it was just a way also of publicising the project that the university was coming up to this 150 years and there were lots of stories to tell.
So ultimately a useful tool.
Yes.
But also kind of a diary for you as well, going through what is a significant part of your life.
I guess so, yes, although I didn't really think of it that way as I was doing it. Mm.
Any idea of the number of interviews that you conducted through this process?
Well, I did. I think it was something like 88 formal interviews. And then I was also fortunate that Dorothy Page had interviewed quite a lot of people at the medical school when she wrote her history 10 years earlier. And with their permission, I was able to listen to people's interviews for that project. And then there were countless people I just chatted to or corresponded with on email and things like that.
Any particularly memorable sit-down conversations, ones that you were just so pleased to have managed to secure for this book?
Well, I think probably there were so many. There were so many fantastic people I spoke to, and sadly several of them have since died, not always the ones I thought might have been going to either. So that was a great privilege. I think, but undoubtedly the most fantastic one was with Ian Chirnside, who I mentioned to you earlier was the chap that had started working at the university in 1922, and he was 106 years old when I met him, and he died a few months later. He was living in a rest home in Upper Hutt, and although he has trouble with his eyesight and his hearing, he was very alert, and it was just a fantastic privilege to meet him. And the really nice thing was I featured his story on the blog, and then the Otago Daily Times picked it up and wrote a story about him. With his permission, I gave them a copy of our interview and they wrote a story about him. And that was lovely because people who had known him got back in touch with him, and he was really thrilled about that. He was a very nice person, and people had very fond memories of him.
As an historian, you might well have your own particular areas of interest. Were you able to kind of satisfy that part of yourself within this process, or were you always having to be mindful that your task was quite a large and broad one?
I think I was very conscious that it was a broad task. So at one point early in the project, I sat down and listed every department and section of the university that needed to have something about them included. And so I was determined to be quite inclusive and make sure a little bit of everyone's story could be in there. There's a vast array of information and I had to be really concise. There was so much that I just couldn't include because of space considerations. But I was also very aware of including the story of Māori students and the university's relationship with the Māori community and the story of early international students, Pacific Island students, and the early women students and early women staff. So I really wanted to include those people that had, in many cases, not had their story told in earlier histories.
The book is a beautiful book. It's not all just words by any stretch of the imagination. And so those images become very important. They tell their own stories in many regards. Tell us a little bit about how you went about the task of making sure you could illustrate this book in the appropriate way.
Well, I knew from the beginning, from prior experience, that you need to start searching for images right at the beginning of a project. And so every person I met and interviewed, I always asked them, did they have any photographs of their time at the university? And many people generously shared some of their photos. A great example was Professor Arthur Campbell, who's an emeritus chemistry professor. And he was a student at Otago in the 1940s, and then he became a staff member later. And he was very interested in the development of the buildings and grounds, and he took quite a lot of slides and photographs, which he has in his own personal collection, and he generously lent those to me, so we could use some of those. They were a great record. I also had a good look through what was available at the Hocken collections of and various people's, individual people's collections and collections of departments and so on. There are lots of photos, a rich resource there.
It's quite a process for those images that you don't have permissions for example, to get all of that stuff done. Were you doing all that on your own? Did you have any help with that?
Well, I was employed to do the research and the writing of the book, so basically I did it all on my own. But people were very supportive and helpful and great and generous in sharing their things from their personal collections all along.
Tell us about the physical book and the way that you have structured it. Have you gone purely chronologically, or how is it ordered in that regard?
No, I decided to write it thematically, which is, some people are a bit surprised at that maybe, but it's the way I always write. I think it's partly an individual thing about the way my brain works, I guess. But I find that writing chronologically tends to, well, it's difficult for people who are using a book. Say you're using a book because you want to know about the history of the dental school, just to take one random example. Well, there's a little bit in chapter one and a little bit in chapter two and so on through all the chapters, and it doesn't always tie together well and you don't see the continuity of it. Whereas if you can write about the way I organised it, there was a chapter, for example, on the health sciences division. So the story of all the health science programs are brought together in that one area, and you can see how they're all related and so on. So I decided to organise it that way. And that allowed me also to do things such as have an individual chapter on the buildings, an individual chapter on the staff, on the student residential areas. And there's a big chapter at the beginning which talks about the founding of the university and its general administration right through its history.
There is the university, then there are the people who work within it, and then there are the students. If this has a leaning in any particular direction, what would it be? Or do you try and cover those bases equally?
I think I tried to cover them equally, but I was conscious that perhaps that there are more students than there are staff, so I really wanted to include the students so they have their own chapters. But of course, the area they work in is included in the other chapters as well. But I wanted to give the staff credit as well. So I guess I tried to include a little bit about everything, which sometimes means you don't have much about some things.
Have you talked much about the relationship between town and gown?
A little bit, yes. So I've in the final chapter especially, I've looked at that, the impact on of the university on Dunedin. And also, not to forget, the university has big campuses in Christchurch and Wellington as well. So there's a chapter on those parts of the university. It also has a small campus now in Invercargill, so I wanted to write about that. Perhaps people in Dunedin aren't so aware of those, so their story was really important to include. But yes, I've talked about that relationship, which I think has been very significant.
You had a deadline, no doubt. As you were approaching that deadline, were there any concerns you had at that point that, I've been trying to dig up more about this particular thing and you really need to cover it? Was there anything that really caused you a bit of sweat towards the end of your deadline?
Well, probably not as far as the research. It was just getting the writing finished.
Yes.
Like, I was working on it till 5 minutes before the deadline, as you always are, even doesn't matter how many years you have. Well, I worked on the project part-time over a long period. That was really great because it meant that things percolate, you know, in your brain and you gradually develop ideas, but also it's more time for people to get in touch with you. So an example would be I'd put a photograph up on the blog that I was hoping to identify some of the people in it, and people would get in touch 2 years later. So having that long period did help. I think one of the frustrating things was there are some unidentified photos in the book, but no doubt people will identify them as soon as it was published. I'll be hearing more.
You must have a strong sense of satisfaction having put this thing to bed now.
Oh, it's been a fantastic project to work on, and it's really great to see it in physical form. And Otago University Press have been just fantastic to work with, and Fiona Moffat there did the design, and I'm just so thrilled with the way it looks.
Who's this book for?
Anyone who might be interested in the university, anyone who's ever been there, anyone who's curious about it.
And in that regard, the style of writing, say something about that.
It's hard to analyse your own style, I guess, but I tried to make it reasonably approachable. But bearing in mind that the university is a large and complex organisation, and it's full of people who are very intelligent and have complex forms of research that you're trying to describe and so on. So I guess some parts of it may be easier for some people to read than others, but I did try and make it approachable. And bearing in mind that I'm not a scientist or a health scientist, then it's a person from the humanities trying to interpret those things, so hopefully making them more accessible for a wider audience.
How organic can this thing be now? You've mentioned, for example, that there might still be some things to be revealed from even material that's from within the book, perhaps stories yet untold, and of course a future unravelling as we go on from this point. What do you know about what life this book will have into the future? Are we likely not to see another perhaps for 50 years or so, or is there a chance for reprints and so forth?
That's a very interesting question. I guess that's up to the university. I think that 50 years is a long time now in the history of an organisation. So the previous history, for example, makes not a single mention of computers, even though the first computer had recently been installed, perhaps 2 or 3 years before the book came out. So things do evolve and change quickly. But I think a book like this remains a reference for a long time until, as you say, a replacement one comes along. I was very conscious that it would be a reference book. That's partly because I work in a reference library, so I work at the Hocken, and so I'm very aware of books being useful as sources for information people are seeking. So I have done things like I've included a timeline at the back, and I've included a list of all the university buildings and the residential colleges to make it easy for people to find those things. And I was conscious of writing things like when a department started and who the first professor was and so on. So people that want those key things will find them somewhere in the book. But of course, in 10 years, there'll be new things will have happened. And I suppose that there are new ways of communicating now. So people do communicate a lot more digitally. So I guess stories, ongoing stories, will be recorded that way as well as in books.
As the celebrations continue through the course of 2019, this book will be picked up and thumbed through and read in depth by many people, many of them Dunedin residents, many Otago residents, many who've been Otago returning for celebrations. That's a really nice thought, isn't it, that after all of this hard work, this will have some real life through 2019 and beyond.
Yes, I mean, it's been fantastic. The great thing about writing the blog too was I was getting some stories out there and sharing them with people and getting feedback. So it's nice to be, I mean, I wasn't doing this project for myself. Obviously, I was doing it for the university and to share this wealth of information. So it's just fantastic to see it getting out there and people being able to read it and enjoy it.
The book is called?
It's called Otago, 150 years of New Zealand's first university.
We decided
not to go with a tricksy title.
And a wonderful book. It is in glorious hardcover. Dr. Ali Clark, thank you so much for coming and having a chat with us today about this huge piece of work. Congratulations on what is a truly wonderful book.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Daring to be Wise, celebrating 150 years of the University of Otago. You'll find podcasts of all episodes from this series online at oar.org.nz. To find out more about the University of Otago's 150th anniversary celebrations, visit otago.ac.nz/150.
Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.